This is episode 24 with Paul Gibbons and Armand Owens.
Welcome to the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. This is your host, Tyler Mongan. I am the president of Haku Global. This is a space for globally minded experts to dialogue about the future of leadership with a focus on the key question, how can leadership be more intelligent about futures? From this conversation, innovative wisdom, practical tools, and actionable insights emerge to help future-ready leaders thrive in an uncertain, complex, and exponentially changing world. Let's jump in to the dialogue.
And today's guests are Paul Gibbons and Armand Owen. Paul is a keynote speaker and specialist in leading change, business strategy, and helping businesses navigate ethical challenges. He is a professor at the University of Denver, and his current project is a four-book series called Leading Change in the Digital Age. His new book, titled The Spirituality of Work and Leadership, Finding Meaning, Joy, and Purpose in What You Do, will be out in the fourth quarter of 2020. This is Paul's second go at the Futures Intelligent Leadership Podcast, and I'm excited to have him back for this episode. Armand Owens is a Command Master Chief in the U.S. Navy, currently stationed in Honolulu, Hawaii. He is also an advisor for Haku Global Leadership Trainings. He is passionate about a concept he calls unsung leadership, which utilizes empathy, compassion, and honor to elicit the best possible results from yourself and your team. In today's episode, we dialogue about the importance of optimizing human performance and not just technological upgrades. Why leadership needs to be humble when making decisions in complexity. Why we need push-ups for the mind to develop human cognition at scale. The distinction between values and results when measuring leadership capabilities, and the difference between leadership bravado and authentic courage. Let's listen. So aloha, Paul and Armand. Thank you for joining me today on this episode. As always, I want to start with this key question of how can leadership be more intelligent about the future? Or futures, given uncertainty, complexity, and exponential change in the world? And I'd like to start with Armand, and you address this from your perspective or from your work.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Tyler. And, obviously from the military standpoint, we operate a lot on precedent. What have we done? What did we do yesterday? What did we do last week? What did we do last year in terms of how we make decisions, how we quote unquote, what we think we're calling innovation, because it's not. So one of the things I'm trying to do on an individual level is help people understand at some point, you gotta slow down and consider what's gonna happen tomorrow, because we never stop in the military. It never stops going. It always is moving from the CO on down. And we never ever take time to think about what's coming around the corner. How are we optimizing human performance? That is one of the biggest gaps in the military that I see, especially in the submarine force. We are really good in acquiring new widgets, so to speak, to put on our submarine, increasing our level of technology to make us more formidable in that way. But in terms of human optimization, in terms of leveraging one's physiology to bring the best possible version of themselves to the table to operate that gear, is something that we lack in. So from a military perspective, I think that we have to get into a place where we are focusing on optimizing human performance, not just upgrading our technology. So.
Great. Thanks, Armand. And Paul, from your perspective, how do you answer the question?
Well, kind of interesting. One of the questions, I was too short and too young to compete in sports. So I competed in things like math team and, debate and French club. And, it's fair to say I didn't go out on a single date when I was in high school. but I want to go out with that guy in the math team. He's still cute. I don't think so. Anyway, but what's interesting for me as someone who competes in mind sports is, are there push-ups for the mind? We have Tiger Woods was, apocryphally, I don't know if it's true, one of the first golfers to take physical training, strength training, endurance training flexibility, yoga, and all of that. I mean, it may be apocryphal, right? Really seriously. So in addition to his specific physical skills, he had these terrifically ample general physical faculties, right? Stamina, strength, endurance, flexibility. And I'm wondering what that is for the mind, you know, and it's one of the things, if I may say, I'm writing in a new book and there's a chapter on mindfulness. It's what are the push-ups? So what are the general mental faculties you need? You need impulse control. You need focus and attention. You need some kind of cognitive flexibility so you know when to be creative and when to stick to the script. And so there's a general list of sort of general mental faculties. And I do wonder, as we, you know, we're already well into the knowledge economy, but as we go to an economy where machines can do more of our kind of rote thinking for us, how we begin to develop ourselves as human beings in ways that I don't still think are very well documented and available. And I don't want to mean that it's just about thinking. The title of my book has actually got the word spirituality in it. And so I'm also thinking about things like, how do we optimize human performance in terms of connection to purpose, from the meaning people get. I'm interested in human ethical performance. And I think that's something else that we need to disregard. It's not just about getting results, but it's getting results in a way that's admirable. And I think that's a really critical value that we need to teach in leadership. So this topic that Armin raised of, you know, improving human performance at scale is something, you know, I think we need to do it as a world. I don't think we just need to do it in the military. And there's certainly, you know, everything that you said about the military, Armin, equally applies to corporate America. And yeah. I think it equally applies to society. So well said.
Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, Armin, from your perspective, kind of following up on all this, now what do you see as some of these kind of core skills to optimize human performance?
Well, first of all, I think an understanding of why we do the things that we do has to be a broad scale understanding from all of our leaders. We attack people for mistakes in the military in a way that is a lot of times unfair. And the consideration for the total human is not brought to bear. For example, a couple of weeks ago, I had to take a young person to captain's mass, which is the form of discipline in the Navy. And before that even made it to my level, the leader at the deck plate level right there, the first line leader, should have had an understanding of about what was going on with that individual. But that is something that we miss a lot of times. And it's not just what's going on emotionally, but what's going on physically. What's going on, you know, how are people taking care of themselves in terms of, you know, are they going to go work out? And not just working out physically. And just like, you know, Paul alluded to, what are the push-ups with regards to cognitive processing? I've personally implemented things that have helped that, and things like HRV, heart intelligence breathing, heart focused breathing, and those type of things. But we don't consider the whole person. So that's one of the biggest issues that I'm seeing that I'm trying to attack and try to implement at a large scale, because we have to, our leaders have to understand how people are coming to, you know, how are they doing that? Why are they doing the things that they're doing? You know, when I have a person that's doing something that's outside the norm, we can't just look at that instance and say, well, they messed up. There has to be mitigating circumstances associated with that. And let's take that into consideration. But a lot of times we don't do it. So I think that's the kind of the first step, is help people understand why people do the things that they do. And I know that sounds, you know, kind of elementary, but leadership really doesn't understand it. They don't know. And they just think people are being malicious. I think a lot of times it's unfair. So.
That's a very, very sophisticated view, actually. It's something I've written about, something I'm very curious about, is it's easier to just blame a person for bad behavior than it is to think about the circumstances. And you know why that's very hard in corporate America? I can't speak for the military. Because all of those other circumstances, the strategy, the working conditions, pay and benefits, the stress level, all of that has to do with the executive. And it's harder for them to go, gee, you know, I wonder if we're creating a kind of workplace environment where people can flourish. I wonder, you know, how this guy experienced so much stress or what he experienced or why they reacted in the way they did. It's harder for them to interrogate their own behavior and their own systems and take responsibility than it is to say, you know, the poor SOB, he was, you know, there before the grace of God go I, you know, the guy obviously had some problems and whatever. And I think what you say is super astute. It's not just a military thing. It's a thing. It's called a fundamental attribution error. We tend to blame the individual rather than think about like how the system might have been contributed to that. So anyway, very astute, very powerful.
Interesting. As you're speaking, it'd be interesting. I'd like to hear this idea of the individual versus the statistic, right? And how that, how leadership can get caught up maybe in the statistic and forget about the individual. Do you have any insight on that, Armand?
Well, in the summary for us, we've just really started to use statistics. We have a model for each submarine that determines how well or how bad their performance, and we call it people-centered metrics. And what that is a measure of seven different aspects of our programmatic success or failure, and puts that into an equation to determine whether or not this submarine is failing or this submarine is succeeding. One of those things is how well individuals are doing on tests, how well individuals are advancing, how at what rate submarines are losing people to mental issues, discipline issues, et cetera. And we plug that into the numbers and this tells us, hey, this is how this submarine is doing. But we found that over the last 10 years, that has not given us the full spectrum of what or how well, you know, that submarine is doing. Essentially, in the same way, how we rate our top officers. We rate our top officers in the nuclear world based on a test they took when they were about 23. And based on that test score, it determines how well of a leader they are and whether or not they're going to go command a submarine when they're about 40. So extremely fascinating how we utilize, statistics and, as it pertains to individuals, because we are not very good in determining, individuals' performances, agreeing on an individual's performance from a collective leadership standpoint.
Well, I mean, the military isn't alone. I mean, not by a long ways. I mean, I've worked in most of my life in corporations and a little bit in universities, and it might be a little bit better, but it's not like paradigm shifting. Oh my God, 100 times better. I think we wrestle with that. I do want to say something general about the question, if I may, because I think it's the time we live in. You talk, I think, about extraordinary change and how leaders can, make big choices and lead during times that are complex. Well, here we are. We're in one. I don't know when you'll air this, but this is being recorded in the middle of May 2020. And as people know, we're trying to decide how quickly we come out of lockdown for COVID-19, and it's a lot of tempers are getting short around the world. But it's taught us a lot, I think, about leadership. It's kind of interesting to me how some people have risen to the top and how some have fallen. Some have been noted as exemplary leaders and some have been known as just really falling short. And one of the things in complex times I think we need from leaders is we know that there is no perfect decision when things are moving as quickly as they're moving right now. Mm-hmm. There's no decision where you'll have absolutely all the information, where the model is going to be 100% right, where, I mean, who could have foretold the Dow falling 10,000 points over You know, one moment we were talking about it reaching 30,000 and the next it was kissing 20. So, you know, these kind of black swan crazy events, they require, I think, from leaders more humility because you're going to make mistakes, and it's what you do with the mistake. And I think they say this in the military. I don't know if it comes from the military, but no, I think it was a German general who said it. No battle plan survives contact with the enemy.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so in these complex times, what we need from our leaders is to be transparent, is to be honest, is to be humble, is to take responsibility when they screw stuff up, because they will, and not to try and persuade us that they're omniscient and they saw this coming and it's all under control. I mean, it's interesting to me because, and I don't know if everybody agrees, that Cuomo is being held as an exemplary leader during this time. New York City and New York State's had it worse than anywhere, you know, almost worse than anywhere in the world. But the way he's communicated, the way he's taken responsibility, the way he's empathized with people, when things go south, he says, you know what, they're going south right now, and we're redoubling and we're doing this, this, and this. And I think it's an interesting study in leadership because in terms of results, you know, could he have done anything about it? I don't know. I mean, they've thrown the kitchen sink at it in New York, right? I mean, they threw everything at it. But the guy, you know, and I think this is widely held, not just among Democrats. Actually, Democrats don't like him because he's kind of a sort of right-wing Democrat, and a lot of my left-wing friends don't like him. But he's being, you know, widely appreciated right now for his leadership. And I think that communication, that empathy, that humility, that willingness to learn from mistakes, that willingness to go the extra mile is really something that's exemplary. I don't know what you see yourself at your end of the world, guys.
No, I think that's great. I think that's, you know, especially in complexity, right? Because the results might not be a good indicator, right, of of the success, and you need some other indicator, whether that be values or, like you said, how you actually handle yourself as a leader. Because if people point to the results, you're going to get a different picture. Armand, with your work, how I'm curious how you see this difference between results, but also the context that you create as leadership.
Yeah, the. It's hard. I tell me and my last CEO, you know, I told him, and I actually told my current CEO, I said, you know, the things that we want to implement, the things that we want to change, and the impact that we want to make, you know, in this place and this time during the 3 years that we're here, by the time we get to about 2 years and 10 months, we'll finally start to see the proof of, you know, what we've done. Right. Just as we're about to leave, we'll see the evidence, and the next person can kind of glean and live off of, you know, the initiatives that we've put in place. You know, so it's extremely hard, especially in the military, just because you only have a 3-year tour. You only have, for the most part, a 3-year tour. So you don't have a lot of time to, you know, to affect a lot of change. So you can't just focus on the results. It can't just be that. It's the little indicators that give you a sense that things are moving in the right direction. You have to prioritize culture over results, because culture is going to be long standing. It's going to exist far greater than you are going to be there. So you have to focus. That's why for me, I focus on the people. I focus on the, you know, the values. I focus on our principles in terms of just looking solely at results. They're going to catch up, and there may be a small dip in performance and results as a result of the change that we're implementing. But it's going to, because it's a long game, I know that it's going to come back, because, you know, if you focus on establishing an environment where people can flourish, they can be autonomous, they can ask questions, they can grow, and there's less fear there, you know, of the leadership, you're going to get the performance and the results, you know, that you want. But, you know, the patience aspect from those that may be above you may be the driving force. So it becomes difficult. But if you know what works, if you know what works, and it's just going to take a little time, you have to be courageous to, you know, to dedicate towards it. So
any follow up on that, Paul?
Yes, interesting. You mentioned another virtue. You mentioned fear a few times during, and then you finally finished with courage too, because that's an interesting thing. Is one of the things I think we have a trouble distinguishing in the world is what courage, where's courage and where's bravado? I think it's kind of interesting thing. When is, to use urban speak, when is someone fronting, and when are they legitimately courageous? And it's an interesting thing. It's very hard to judge, you know. And we all have our leaders who are in the public view. We all have our preconceptions and predispositions towards them. But do we have an idea what courageous behavior looks like in our current complex social time? Like, what does courageous behavior from a politician look like? Does it look like not wearing a mask? No, that looks kind of foolhardy, especially if you're asking everyone else to do it, right? That looks really foolhardy. You know, what this balancing sort of courage and the courage to have confidence in your right actions, but also the humility to know that sometimes you'll make a good decision that turns out wrong. I think it's my friend who's a poker professional. She writes books. She's a very famous poker player, Annie Duke. She wrote a book called Thinking and Bets. And you'll forgive me, I don't know anything about American football. But apparently there was a time when the Patriots and Belichick had the ball, I don't know, third and one or something like that. And they had a choice between kicking a field goal and going for a fourth down or whatever. Some kind of decision that was a really close decision. Anyway, they made the decision they made. I can't remember if they went for it or they didn't go for it. They probably went for it and threw an interception, lost the game. Anyway. And everybody said, what a terrible decision. And actually afterwards, in the cold light of day, when it was looked at by people who are, you know, seriously, you know, good tacticians in American football, they said, no, actually it was the right call. It was the percentage call, because here are the numbers, right? The numbers are that play is going to work 85% of the time, and that other play is going to work 13% of the time, right? And he went for the percentage play, but, you know, at the time they got lucky, or they read the play, or, you know, something like that. And so you need to be sure of yourself, but you also need to be humble enough to realize that you can make a good decision and get a bad result. And unfortunately too, you can make bad decisions and get good results too, because luck works both ways.
Yeah. What do you all think
about? It's a great book, by the way. It's called Thinking and Bets. So she's a sort of poker nut, and she basically says we treat the world as if it's a chess game, and we can, when the world is much more like a poker game. And all of the decisions we make as people and as business leaders, and I assume as military leaders too, I don't know if she has much experience for that, are based on based on probabilities. You're actually making the best judgment that you can based on how you think the world is going to turn out. And guess what? You're not always right. So it's an interesting book, Thinking and Bets.
That's a good recommendation.
Oh, you should get her on here, by the way. She's great.
Oh, yeah, that would be great.
She's very fun and charismatic. She made her living as a poker player. She's like 45 years old, and she went back to school and did a PhD, and now she's a big sort of conference speaker guru type lady.
Wow. Paul, can you talk a little bit about, from your perspective of the work you're doing now with ethics, how you see like ethics and even spirituality playing into future intelligence, maybe even what we're kind of experiencing right now in complexity?
Well, one of the problems with ethics is that it's very hard to agree on what an ethical business looks like. it gets into the realm of politics sometimes. I mean, I remember Delta Airlines, when there was a mass shooting, said we're not going to give discounts for NRA members anymore. And they got boycotted or something like that, and it cost them a lot of money. And so for a lot of people, they were like, yay, you know, they're making an appropriate gesture. Or Dick's raised the age from which you could purchase an assault rifle to 21 from 18. And some people praised that, and it also cost Dick's a lot of customers. So we don't agree as a world on what ethics looks like, I don't think, often enough. And the consequence of that is one of the things I write just a lot about, so writing a lot about, is it's just like there's an ethical failure, an ethical lapse in business, a huge one. I mean, they obviously happen every day on a small level, you know, almost every like 6 months. If you think about Wells Fargo, if you think about this guy, Pharma Bro, who increased the price of this HIV drug by 750%, you know, if you think about Volkswagen, who deceived millions, many millions of automobile buyers that their cars were cleaner than they want. You think about, you know, their legion, there's these, I can go through, and even between sips of coffee, I could come up with 12 or 15 of these, and not from the past decades. I'm talking about like the past 3 years. There are so many of these things. The opioid crisis is yet another one where it looks like there are people that had their hand in the cookie jar. That's not exactly what happened, but you know, they were in a sense manipulating, and guilty of a lot of bad sales and bad advertising practices. And, you know, they got millions of lives on their hand. So I do think a lot about, and I do wonder, you know, what's going to guide us. You know, if you could send someone like the CEO of Uber, who was pilloried in the press, Travis Kalanick, you know, if you could send him to an ashram or to Bible school or to whatever, you know, wherever, like where could you send this guy so that this guy would have an appropriate moral compass? Or do we just have to take our chances as a world? And it seems to me right now we're living in a world where we sort of just take our chances ethically. And then again, we do the same thing that Armin talked about easier, is that when there's a mistake, like a Wells Fargo kind of mistake, we blame the CEO or we blame Wells Fargo. But what we know is that all of the banks do somewhat, maybe not as shady as Wells Fargo, but we do things that are, you know, not the most honorable practices. Mm. We know all the pharmaceutical companies are using all sorts of methods to sell their drugs and have physicians prescribe their drugs, whether they're needed or not. Mm. So we sort of like, it's not so much for me a case of a sort of few rotten apples. It's sometimes you have to turn around and you have to, if you get three rotten apples out of a barrel, you have to think, well, maybe it's not just a rotten apple. Right. Maybe it's a rotten barrel, you know?
Absolutely.
So I do worry a lot about ethics, and I wish I had a magic bullet, right? And the book I'm writing right now is like, does it come from religion, or does it come from spirituality, or does it come from something that sits above both of those, or like, what are the highest human values that we can aspire to, and how do we have our businesses run along those lines? And so anyway.
It's very interesting because, you know, and especially right now in this complex times, it seems like at least a lot of governments and organizations that are doing well are the leaders are driving through the organization through values, right? Versus results, right? And when you don't have a strong, like it seems like related to your work, is that you don't have a strong like moral compass or ethics, that's going to be very more and more disruptive potentially in the future. I don't know. Armin, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think the point that you just made, you know, illustrates exactly what we're talking about, because companies that are driving their decisions through their values, they may take a loss on the front end, but long term they're going to have a group of people that, you know, buy into that organization way stronger than, you know, an incentive or anything like that on the back end could ever, you know, entice them to stay or whatever the case may be. In Hawaii, you're seeing a lot of that. In my organization, you know, the challenge is I'm trying to balance providing a maintenance service for an entire fleet at the same time, you know, keeping 6,200 people, you know, safe.
Yeah.
So what do you tell people? Is the mission the priority? Mm. Is the results the priority? Because I have, you know, the Department of the Navy, the Department of Defense, the, you know, the Commander in Chief expecting to have this unit in this place performing, you know, this action. Meanwhile, there's a ton of risk associated with bringing all of my people in that to work on that unit to be able to meet that mission, and how we communicate that is huge. So some of the things that we've been able to, you know, to communicate have taken a little bit, has slowed, you know, slowed down our production just a little bit, but where our focus has been, where our energy has been, is making sure that our people have been safe. And one of the things that we're seeing because of it is we're still being able to meet our performance goals. We had a slight dip, and now we're back doing as good or in better in a lot of areas, you know, just because, you know, we're leading through our values. We got a lot of feedback initially about some of the actions that we were taking with regards to making sure that we didn't put people in danger as far as high risk personnel and if they had high risk family members and and things of that nature. But we've flexed our schedules. We've moved people in different directions. We've thought outside the box as it pertains to teleworking and all these different things that were not in place prior to. But those things, our values forced us to think outside the box because we could no longer operate on the model that we did, a month ago and still accomplish, the level of performance that we have, that the Navy and, the Department of Defense expects of us. So it's, like I said, just even when I was talking about earlier with regards to establishing that culture and some of the, the results that you may lose out on in the short term, you're going to gain massively in the long term because it's a long, to quote Simon Sinek, it's an infinite game, right? And we can't just get caught up by what's happening right now in terms of our performance. It has to be values because the people that we have the privilege of leading, they're going to judge us based on, what we say. I mean, they're going to judge us based on what we do. They only have listened to what we say, but they're really going to judge us on what we do. And if those things are not aligned, then we're going to lose them in our performance. Even if we have full power lineup, it's still not going to meet the need.
Paul, any follow-up thoughts on that?
I'm moved with curiosity. The Navy is very good at staying out of the news. Of all the things I named, I think something about the way the U.S. military seems to be run to me, for the size of the organization that it is, it seems to me they're probably doing something right. I wouldn't want to take that too far, but compared to the litany of corporate scandals I went through, but anyway, one of the questions I have is this, an interesting question. You may not be able to comment on this, so please say, I probably shouldn't say anything, but what's the view on the ground of what happened to the aircraft carrier captain who wrote an email saying, hey, people are getting sick and this is, we're at crisis levels, and then, excuse me, he got fired. Yep. And I think more has happened since then. I mean, you can't comment officially, obviously, that.
I can't, talk about the, any of the specifics. But, I will say that there was in talks with my peers, there's a lot of contention because there exists, very strong opinions on both sides for or against them. And one of the things that the Navy that allows us to continue to be as strong as we are, is good order and discipline. Is adhering to the chain of command. And whether or not people think that decision was right or wrong, adherence to good order and discipline, good order and discipline was compromised in that moment. The chain of command, the integrity of the chain of command was compromised, in that moment. So there is that aspect, of that situation.
It seems like it's part of the values, right, of the organization.
Absolutely.
Is that right? It's one of the strong values in there as well.
Yeah.
And if that gets compromised, right, that becomes a big problem.
Right? Well, I dare say that there are other values too, right?
Yeah,
I
mean, it's not true.
The only value, right? There's honesty. There's care for the well-being of the men. I mean, I don't know how many people are on an aircraft carrier, 5,000, 7,000. I mean, a lot of people.
Yeah, 5,000.
You're in between 5,000 and 6,000.
So there are. It's not like there's only one value that we need to pay attention to in something this kind.
Right.
Yeah, and if you're talking about, when you talk about values for the military, because you got to think all these people, from so many different walks of life, all, being brought together and united for one purpose, right? And that thing that we're united upon is, honor, courage, and commitment, right? Hey, I understand what you may have learned, in inner city Texas or, backwoods South Dakota, in terms of how life should look and how you should carry yourself. But here in this organization, we operate on honor, courage, and commitment. And that's how we make our decisions. That's how we carry ourselves. And that's what we unite ourselves to.
You know, but you have to imagine, right? This guy's had a 30-year career with the Navy, probably, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you don't get to run a aircraft carrier right out of Annapolis, right? And he's had a 30-year career, and he couldn't have had a 30-year career without paying the strictest attention to the chain of command for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And here's the time. He knew exactly what he was doing. Mm-hmm. And so what you said, Armand, before about, you know, we sort of blame the individual is I imagine, and I don't know too much about what was in his head at the time, he knew that he was doing something which was, you know, in that sense, breaking part of the code or something like that. He thought he was presumably doing it for a higher purpose, like, you know, protecting the lives of 5,000 or 7,000 people. How many people are on an aircraft carrier?
Yeah, between 5,000 and 6,000.
Yeah.
For the operations that they were doing.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, he knew he would... Presumably, he knew what he was doing, and he probably knew that he might well get relieved of his command for it. So it's interesting. I wonder why he thought this was really important. That's a question I suppose I'd ask myself.
Well, some of the other conversations that I've had are, you know, the difference between, you know, thinking tactically versus, you know, thinking strategically, right? Because something tactically at a tactical level on the battlefield could look cataclysmic. Right. But from a strategic level, it's okay, this is, yes, this is a concern, but it's not the concern.
Right. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I think it's a very interesting case. I mean, it plays a lot into like ethics. I think what Paul, like you're referring to this higher, you know, this higher order or something else, right? Because the situation demanded that.
I think we like to think that we can boil ethical decisions down to like this thing is right or wrong.
Right.
And it ain't like that. Mm. It's often a trade-off at right. As I think Armand said earlier on, it's the welfare of men versus a tactical advantage or something, you know, something of that thing, or the welfare of the men versus a production schedule. Or there's the, these sorts of dilemmas are ever present. It's a conflict between values. Usually it's not about, which value, but you know, all of these things are important. Honesty is important. Integrity is important. And so frequently we are called upon to make trade-offs, to make ethical trade-offs between different things that look at the same time like they're equally important, right? Mm. How do we develop in people, I think the question is how do we develop in people the skills to think through, you know, really difficult ethical decisions, which all of us face all the time. I mean, Armand faces them all the time. And when I was in corporate life, I faced them all the time. I mean, for example, you know, I once had a client who wanted to fire one of the consultants who was on a project. And I thought that the client did not have good reason to do so. You know, this sort of was a little interpersonal spat, if you will. Mm. And so I was torn between, well, the client's already right. And the second thing I was torn between, well, this is someone's career. You know, and it, you don't want on a record that you got asked to leave a client, plus, you know, what it would do to her in terms of, you know, humiliation and all of that and her development. And, you know, I actually ended up having a hard conversation with the client. I said, this is something appropriate. And, you know, I'd like a second chance here. Give me 30 days and we'll review the situation. So, I mean, it was a tough dilemma. And in fact, the easier thing would have been to say the client's almost right. You know, good luck, honey. Good luck on the next job. You know, whatever. And I feel like the thing that I did was the more difficult of the two things. And I think, you know, in a really sort of modest way, I mean, super modest, right? I think it was the more courageous thing to do, right?
Is yeah, to absolutely.
Stand up to a client and say, you know, sorry, brother, it's not the way it looks.
Yeah. Any follow up on that, Armand?
Yeah, I absolutely think it's that was a courageous stance to have. The problem is that we don't have a lot of leaders that are willing to take those courageous stands.
Yeah.
Right. That self-preservation is huge. Our egos are huge. And, you know, going back to the original point with regards to, you know, future leadership, we have to have leaders that are willing to put that self-preservation aside, be willing to put their ego, you know, in place, be willing to confront what they had, the pain and agony they have going on within them, because they know what's coming around the corner and look at it head on and face it and just deal with it.
Ego is no friend to a leader. I think we could probably all like have a Mexican wave that ego is one of the things that gets most in the way of leadership effectiveness. Mm. Oh, I mean, my decision, the guy could have said, well, you know, not only is she fired, you can take a hike too, you know, it's my career. It could have gone really badly. Anyway. Yeah. Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah. It's interesting. Cause I mean, I think it seems like, I don't know. It seems like a lot of leadership would try to keep their job. They'd be worried about keeping their job first, right? Yep. I mean, and not being able to make that tough decision or bring up some type of conflict, potentially conflicting advice that could lead to their job loss as well. Yeah, and I think we need more of that in the future. I think it's interesting right now because there's, you know, people are making some very tough decisions in the political space. And there's a lot of, I think there's going to be a lot of unintended consequences of the decisions. Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see how leadership owns up to those as well.
Right? Yeah. And we don't know. The fact is, you know, there's so much uncertainty that we don't know. I mean, people now, the sort of culture is shifting towards the measures we took were too extreme. I know so many, I have so many friends on the right side, of the political, on the, not right, like in correct, but right as in right wing. Side of the political fence who think this has all been overblown and we've crippled the economy because a couple of eggheads at the World Health Organization and this guy Fauci and people like Bill Gates, and it's been some conspiracy, you know, I'm trying to fathom their thinking or something like that. Mm-hmm. But the sort of the center of gravity is moving that way. And the fact is, unfortunately, we'll never know. What had happened is if when President Trump said, March 16th or March 20th or whatever it is, we're going to begin lockdowns. The state started locking down before that. We won't know what happened if they had said what American leadership was saying in February. It was, it's all good. We got this under control. It's only a dozen cases, blah, blah. We'll never know what that world looks like, unfortunately. And similarly, as we were stepping into this sort of going back to work phase and unfreezing the lockdown is we're not going to know. And we're just going to have to be very sensitive to what the data and what the scientists are telling us as we come out. Like, are we seeing spikes and hotspots and all of that kind of thing? And again, be willing to lead with humility, as because, you know, whatever stance you're taking as a governor right now, whether you're opening your state quickly or whether you're opening your state slowly, there's a reasonable chance you'll be wrong.
Yep.
and
you know, no matter what you do, right?
50 governors, and they're not all going to get it right.
Yeah,
that's for sure. And here's the thing that I'm most worried about, though, is that even in that, just like you were alluding to, spending, you know, worrying about what we could have, you know, what we did and how that could have affected it, we want to spend so much energy and consume so much time worrying about the woulda, coulda, shouldas, you know, that we're not going to be in a headspace to be able to move forward and to make decisions based on the best information that is, that exists in the present.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And I see that Hawaii has done really well on coronavirus. I think from the very get-go, you guys got hold of this and really stomped it out. You didn't flatten the curve, you stomped the curve, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. It was, you know, we had a, you know, a couple of cruise ships come in with a couple of people that were infected. And then the governor was like, hey, we're locking down the state. And there was a lot of churn here, but, you know, it worked. You know, so,
it seemed to. Your numbers were way better than any other state. And you think there were some good decisions made by leadership? Is that the sense I'm getting?
I think so. I think a lot of those decisions were also, were courageous as well, because there are a lot of people saying we don't need to do that. We don't need to go that route. Because you got to think about it. About 40-50% of the state's economy comes, you know, from tourism, right? So you're going to cut that. You're literally going to cut that out of your budget. That takes a lot of courage to do that. So.
Yeah. Let's wrap up here because we're running out of time, but, any last thoughts, Paul, on this conversation?
Well, I think it takes a crisis. In a crisis, you see the true mettle of leaders, you know? And I think we've seen leaders who have brought people together and collaborated and empathized and have really thought about the we and not the me. And then we have leaders who have done that less. And so we've seen that. And I think this has also brought out the best in humanity. You know, when you wear a mask, it doesn't do shit for you. It's for protecting other people. And yet when I look around in my grocery store, everyone's wearing a mask. And that kind of mass kind of altruistic behavior at scale, at the billion scale. And I think this has also brought us together as a globe. Like, there's no country or no state or no community on the world which has been able to hide, like, this is a global problem. Unlike, you know, I mean, like many things like climate change, but unlike most of the things we see. And I think it's brought us together. I mean, I think there's been some remarkable stuff. I mean, businesses have found themselves adaptability. Businesses have wanted people on the whole to work more from home and to move to virtual working and to travel less and to spend less money on travel and all of that kind of stuff. And they ripped the Band-Aid off in a week. You know, stuff that would have taken 5 or 10 years. Like, everybody's working from home. And it was overnight. And, you know, how horrible was it? Well, actually, no, it's not been bad at all. and so we proved ourselves able to innovate quickly. We proved ourselves being altruistic. There have been new business models. A friend of mine started one for music, which is called All Day I Stream, which is all of the different music festivals and venues and DJs and events and dance parties and virtual dance parties that are going along around the world. I mean, there's been that. There's been more what they call robotic manufacturing, robotic delivery, you know, rapid retooling of businesses to make sanitizers and masks and ventilators. So, I mean, I think it sparked a white heat of collaboration and innovation. And I'm sort of inspired by the way that humanity has responded to it, even though, you know, the suffering has been great. You know, I have a friend who lost a friend and left behind some ridiculous number of children, like 9 freaking children, you know, and, you know, there's no way. And they couldn't even say goodbye to their father either, because obviously there was no way for them to do that. So it's deeply tragic at a sort of really visceral and emotional level. But I also think we are seeing some of humanity at its very best. So that's my final word.
Thanks, Paul. And Armand?
Yeah, I got to tell you, I definitely agree with your final word there. I think that ultimately the people and the organizations, you know, the teams that will, the quickest ones to view this as an opportunity are going to be the ones that come out the best here, because I think this is an absolute opportunity. You know, in the midst of chaos, in the midst of, you know, all the things that are going on with COVID-19, you know, the ones that can, you know, the ones that are quickest, you know, to view this as, hey, not a problem, you know, but an opportunity, I think we're going to, you know, see the rise of companies that weren't previously on the Fortune 500. I think we're going to see leaders that, you know, previously didn't have names and have followings that are going to become, you know, more visible for the future after this occurrence. And I'm extremely encouraged by it. Encouraged by, you know, what I see in podcasts. I'm extremely encouraged by what I see, you know, in this state, in my command, and you know, in the Navy, in a lot of senses, because the people that I talk to are looking at it more so, you know, from, hey, this is an opportunity for us to get better. This is an opportunity for us to reveal where we've had holes in our processes, where we've had, you know, deficiencies and obstacles that now we have the actual time to address. You know, so I'm extremely encouraged about, you know, what this is going to bring. What changes are going to be implemented, and I hope that as this is seen as an opportunity, that people continue to have the courage to carry this out. That is not a short term result of an emergent situation, but a long term, you know, change in behavior. So,
great. And as always, I want to ask you to leave one word for future intelligent leadership. So, Paul, what's your one word?
Humility.
Armand?
I think resilience.
Great. Well, thank you, Paul and Armand, for being on the episode today. Really appreciate your insights and your wisdom and your time. Aloha.
Thank you. Aloha.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining us today on the Flowcast. To get a summary of today's dialogue, find out more about today's guests, listen to previous episodes, or discover more about Haku Global's neuroscience-based Futures Intelligent Leadership programs, or customized strategic foresight and innovation sprints, visit us at www.haku.global. At Haku Global, we believe it is time for more futures intelligent leadership. The future is something we need to think more intelligently and feel more deeply about so we can collaborate to discover today's solutions for future problems. If you are in a leadership role and need support or training to scale futures intelligence across your organization, then contact us at Haku Global. This is your host, Tyler Mongan, and until next time, have a preferred and conscious future. Aloha.